And he, bam, in my side, in my back, and made me run with my hand on my head over to the side. And before I got over there, 2-3 more correction officers with him now, and everybody's hitting me.
That was former Attica prisoner Frank Big Black Smith, not to be confused with Mike Smith, who was a guard. Tom Robbins and Antonio Yarbo, I want to thank you for being with us. Should Attica be closed?
I think there is such festering fear at that place that it needs something very radical. Closure would certainly be a good response.
Antonio?
Yes, it should be closed.
Should be turned into a museum.
We're going to do part two of this discussion after the show and post it at democracynow.org. And we're going to link to the major New York Times piece Tom Robbins has written. He works now with the Marshall Project. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Matos, Steve Martinez, and Anna.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The news is next.
Tune in to International Women's Day this Sunday for live music from the KBOO studios from 7 to 10 p.m. Shirley Certain and Just Jess will host Annie Dang, Rachel Taylor Brown, and Butterfly Breakdown, as well as some recordings from the KBOO Live Music Archive. That's 7 p.m. this Sunday for International Women's Day.
Shake, 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 shake. Come on now and move your hips in. Shake, 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 shake.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the state of Oregon becomes the first in the country to provide automatic voter registration at the DMV.
The family of Michael Brown, killed in Missouri last August, have filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the city of Ferguson.
A village in Peru has won a settlement from Occidental Petroleum for the poisoning of their traditional land in the Amazon rainforest.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 5th, 2015. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Pat Epstein. Attorneys for the family of Michael Brown announced today that they would file a wrongful death lawsuit against the city of Ferguson and Darren Wilson, the officer who killed Michael Brown last August. Wilson was cleared of wrongdoing by a Ferguson grand jury in November. Yesterday, the U.S. Department of Justice also cleared Officer Wilson, announcing that it would not bring federal civil rights charges against Wilson for killing Michael Brown. However, Attorney General Eric Holder said yesterday that an investigation into the Ferguson Police Department revealed a, quote, highly toxic environment, end quote, of racism and misconduct with the police force.
Workers at the Portland Airport held a teach-in at the airport today to demonstrate the hazardous conditions they encounter at work. The workers have recently filed complaints with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration against Prospect Airport Services, a contractor at PDX Airport who's responsible for providing cabin cleaning and other services. At the teach-in, workers showed what it's like to clean airplane toilets with substandard equipment. They also provided visual examples of the makeshift solutions they're forced to implement in lieu of adequate supplies. For more on this, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Meg Niemi with the Service Employees International Union Local 49, which represents workers at the Portland Airport.
What are some of the conditions that are faced by these workers?
Yeah, so they clean airplanes often at night or in between when planes are coming and going from the port. And some of the safety concerns that they have are about working at the airport is that they actually don't have enough equipment or supplies to appropriately clean the planes and to keep themselves safe. So an example would be having disposable gloves that don't rip. So that they're not in contact with bodily fluids and some of the toxic chemicals that they might be using to clean the planes. Some of the other examples and concerns that they have is they use a set of stairs that they roll up to the rear entrances of the planes, which is where they enter and exit the planes in order to clean them. And they one of the sets of stairs that they use to get in and out of the planes falls short. And so they basically have to jump up to be able to get into the plane. And, you know, you have to imagine this is at night. It's often wet. It could be icy. And recently, one of the workers actually fell trying to get out of the plane.
How have the workers challenged the company? What steps have they taken?
Well, I think, you know, one thing is that we represent a number of workers at the airport, some of the janitors who actually clean the main part of the airport. And because those workers have a voice on the job and a way to advocate for themselves and for their own safety as well as the cleanliness of the port, we were reached out to by many other port employees who said, we want to also have that kind of voice on the job. So the prospect workers and hundreds of other workers at the port have been coming together in order to form a union and have shown that support by signing petitions. They actually were part of doing a survey of employees at the port and reaching out and finding out what were the conditions like at the port for workers there, which were pretty astounding. They've also asked the Port of Portland to adopt a policy around minimum standards and that would include some minimum standards for the contractors that contract at the port around improved safety, training, and equipment standards.
How hard is it for workers who are, say, subcontracting for a contractor to actually be unionized? Is it more difficult than other workers?
Well, generally, it's not easy for workers to be able to form a union, and no matter what kind of situation that they're in, the port is a very unique place where there are some employees who work directly for the Port of Portland, some employees that work directly for airlines, and then there are a number of subcontractors at the port, some who contract directly to the port and some through the airlines. And so it's a complicated situation, but what's happening with workers out there is that all of those subcontracted out workers for tons of different companies have come together all at one time saying that we want to be able to have a union and have a voice on the job.
And how can listeners find out more or get involved in this campaign?
Yeah, it would be great to have some KBOO listeners get involved in this campaign. There's a lot of information at our Tumblr page, which is rpdx.tumblr.com. And there you can find out information and sign up to be able to get more involved in supporting the airport employees.
Meg Neamy is with the SEIU 49, representing airport workers at the airport in Portland. And that website, if you want to find more information, is ourpdx.tumblr.com. That's ourpdx.tumblr.com. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The Board of Commissioners from Multnomah County has voted to restrict the sale of e-cigarettes to minors and prohibit the use of e-cigarettes in business places where traditional smoking is already banned. According to the Multnomah County Board of Health, 10% of high school students have tried e-cigarettes, and e-cigarette use has tripled amongst 11th graders since the device became popular in recent years. The ordinance will not exempt vape shops from the smoking ban, a stipulation that several people testifying at City Hall claimed to be unfair due to the need for consumers to try out products within vape shops. The ordinance will go into effect in 30 days on April 5th. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke earlier today with Gregory Conley from the American Vaping Association.
What are your thoughts on how this ordinance addresses some of the issues associated with e-cigarettes, and how does it also fall short?
Well, the Board of Commissioners was correct to pass a common sense ban on the sale of vapor products to minors. However, by equating the deadly act of smoking with the use of a smoke-free and tobacco-free vapor product, they have abused the science, and they are misleading smokers and the loved ones of smokers all across Multnomah County into believing that these products may actually present similar hazards, which all the scientific evidence says that they do not.
How is this ordinance going to affect e-cigarette consumers? I mean, they're not going to be able to smoke within the stores that they would otherwise be buying the pens in. They won't be able to try things out. But other than that, for adult e-cigarette consumers, is it going to present a significant burden or obstacle for them to enjoy the e-cigarettes?
For those who have already switched to vaping, this vaping ban hopefully will not cause any of them to go back to smoking. That's certainly not guaranteed, though. But the big effect will be on existing smokers, the hundreds of thousands, possibly over a million or two in Oregon, who are still inhaling burning smoke into their lungs. The Multnomah County Board just took away one of the best incentives for smokers to switch, which is when it is winter time, if a business owner is willing to allow you to use it, you do not have to go outdoors. And you add that to, as you mentioned, this ordinance bans vaping in vape shops that sell the products, that teach people how to use them, that help people find a flavor that's actually satisfying to them and something that can help them possibly get off cigarettes. So this is a double whammy for smokers. Not only are they taking away a prime incentive for a smoker to switch, but they're making it much, much more difficult for them to find a vapor product that will suit their needs.
Obviously, there's a pretty clear public health incentive to restrict the sale and possession of them to minors, but what is the motivation behind preventing them from being able to be smoked indoors or in vape shops?
It is a combination of ideology, the fear of the unknown, and media and activist misinformation. So what you have is that you have the media, so many stories that are coming out that are highlighting negative, slanted stories performed by researchers that are performing them improperly, leading to bad results, but the media only putting out names of scary chemicals found in e-cigarette vapor, for example, without mentioning that the levels of chemicals are far below what is the max limit set for inhalable medications that the FDA regulates, for instance. You have people who they have to study hundreds of issues every year, and they're expected to somehow be an expert. And so when they have activist groups like the American Lung or American Cancer Society come into their office and tell give very misinformed statements about vapor products that are based more in an ideology that hates the sight of something that looks like smoke, and it's based more on that than it is science, legislators are being misinformed. We are hopeful that they will take the opportunity to inform themselves of the actual science on this topic and that they will move away from the proposed vaping ban and instead simply enact a bill to make Oregon the 41st state to ban sales of vapor products to minors.
Yeah, kind of going along that line of research indicating that e-cigarettes could be harmful to your health. What are your thoughts on the recent study by Portland State University researcher David Payton, which found that there are significantly high levels of formaldehyde in e-cigarette smoke or vape?
I would recommend everyone read Joe Nocera's column in the New York Times tearing apart that researcher for his completely ill-suited, completely ideological research setup, where he did not study the product before testing it, and so he used it in a way that vastly overheated the vapor product, produced formaldehyde in an amount that no actual human user would ever be able to withstand. They did not use human vapors in the lab. They used a machine, and a machine is not a human lung. The New York Times' Joe Nocera is not the only person in public health and journalism to strongly criticize that research. We would not be surprised if within the next 4 to 6 months, the New England Journal of Medicine takes some sort of action to note that that study is misleading, because it is questionable why they published it in the first place. And even Mr. Paykow, I believe his last name is, who performed the research, he admitted that he was horrified that news outlets were presenting his research in a way to suggest that vaping could be nearly as hazardous as smoking. He was horrified, according to the New York Times journalist that interviewed him.
That was Greg Lee Conley with the American Vaping Association, and this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
The Oregon State Senate today has approved a bill that could add up to 300,000 people to the state's voter rolls. The so-called motor voter bill will automatically register people to vote when they register or update their driver's licenses here in the state. Oregon is the first state in the country to pass a bill to automatically register voters, and the move has been cheered by groups such as Common Cause. Supporters of the bill say that the bill is simply an effort to reduce barriers to entry and increase representation in the legislative process. Detractors have pointed to problems that the Oregon Secretary of State's website has had in the past, including 3 different data breaches in the past year alone. They say that the state is not sufficiently prepared to protect people's data with a fully electronic voter registration database. Oregon Governor Kate Brown was one of the main backers of this legislation when she was Secretary of State, and the bill is now moving to her desk for approval.
Today, the Oregon Senate passed the bill known as the Clean Fuels Bill, which passed the House yesterday. The bill is aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions from transportation fuels. Senator Brian Boquist spoke in favor of the bill.
This bill increases the fee on motor fuel metering devices. Now, of course, that's just everybody understands what that is. Not, okay? What that is you see in my hand, I have a Dasani water bottle, which is 20 fluid ounces. Now, I know there's somebody in the government that regulates the 20 fluid ounces. What this bill does, it says, is if you go and buy a gallon of fuel at your local service station, you get a gallon of fuel. It says, is if you guys are on the other side, notice I said the other side, not the far side, the other side, and you go buy your biofuels, it is actually biofuels. If you're on our side and you want to go out and buy that premium octane, and it's premium octane without the biofuels, you're getting premium octane. That's what this is all about. The problem we have here is some years ago, the legislature looked at this and said, this has to pay for itself, and we presently charge $5 for them to come out and make sure that there's a gallon of fuel and that the sticker says the pump is what you're getting. The problem is it doesn't pay for itself. So this bill, over the next 5 years, gradually increases the fee from $5 to $10 for them to go out to some 31,000 devices and make sure the devices actually give you a gallon of fuel and they actually give you what it says it's there. With that, Mr. President, I would urge a yes vote, unfortunately.
The Clean Fuels Bill passed the Oregon Senate today and now goes to Governor Brown for approval.
Members of an indigenous tribe in Peru known as the Achuar have won an undisclosed sum out of court from the United States oil giant Occidental Petroleum. The Achuar tribe sued the company back in 2007 for pollution, which they allege has caused birth defects, has caused also premature deaths, and damage to their habitats in a northern river basin of the Amazon. The case was originally dismissed in 2008 by a federal district court. That court argued that the case should be heard in Peru rather than here in the United States. But members of the Peruvian tribe have won an appeal to overturn that decision, and the Supreme Court of the United States refused to even hear the oil company's arguments back in 2013. This is the first time that a United States company has been sued in a United States court for pollution that it caused in another country. This lawsuit sets a precedent for other cases against United States companies that are currently being held in U.S. courts that have caused environmental damage in other countries. ¶¶
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring a discussion with local community activist Lori Palmer about the devastating effects of youth gang violence and how to curtail gang involvement. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny and pleasant, with partial clouds and a 0% chance of rain, with a high of 67 and a low of 38. Today in history, in 1770, British troops killed 5 Americans in an event known as the Boston Massacre, contributing to the outbreak of the American Revolution 5 years later. Almost 200 years later, in 1965, the March Intifada began in Bahrain against British colonial rule. The uprising was sparked by the layoff of thousands of oil workers and resulted in the deaths of 6 civilians at the hands of security forces. While the uprising was unsuccessful, Bahrain declared its independence 6 years later. The quote of the day is from John Adams in defense of the British soldiers who perpetrated the Boston Massacre. Facts are stubborn things.
It's 20 minutes after 5 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Being a Congress critter is not as cushy a job as many assume. After all, they have to write legislation, organize hearings, write speeches, round up votes, and do all sorts of other legislative-y things to pass laws. Oh, wait, my mistake. Members now have staffs to do all that, including telling the esteemed legislators how to vote. Few people are aware that congressional staffs have mushroomed and gained far-reaching control over legislation. While the mass media has ignored this power shift, which further removes the people from the making of our laws, corporate lobbyists have long understood it and assiduously wooed staff members with flattery and gifts. But then it dawned on lobbyists that instead of wooing staff, they should simply become the staff. So, when Republicans took charge of the Senate in January, K Street moved right into the Capitol Hill offices of the new corporate-hugging majority. What a sight to see Tom Chapman, top lobbyist for U.S. Airways, now sitting atop the legal staff of the Senate Aviation Panel that oversees, guess who, U.S. Air. And there's Joel Leftwich, senior lobbyist for PepsiCo, where he's pushed furiously to water down the Ag Department's nutrition standards for school lunches. Now, he can do much more for the peddler of Pepsi Cola and Cheetos, for he's the new staff director for the Senate Ag Committee, which will rewrite the school lunch funding law this year. What a coincidence. How about mega lobbyist Mark Isakowitz, whose specialty is punching loopholes in the Wall Street reform law? As new chief of staff for Senator Rob Portman, Mark is now punching from the inside, and he's already slipped a special regulatory exemption into law on behalf of the big derivative traders like GE and the Koch brothers. This is Jim Hightower saying, let me ask, if you voted Republican last fall, is this the change you wanted?
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
Last Thursday, we reported on the Washington County Board of Commissioners' unanimous but controversial vote to close the 2 remaining public health clinics in the county. Now, activists in the county have filed an initiative to limit elected officials to 2 terms in an effort to shake up the composition of the board. Co-sponsors Daniel Vasquez and Tom Black, both longtime vocal critics of the board's decisions, point to the fact that board chairman and Andy Dyke have been on the board for 21 years. His fellow commissioner Roy Rogers, who was absent from last week's vote to close the clinics, has been serving for 30 years straight, making him one of the state's longest-serving local officials. The County Elections Board has yet to issue a title for the initiative, but is required to make a decision within 5 days of the filing at which the supporter will begin gathering signatures to put it on the ballot. KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with initiative sponsor Tom Black for more.
Can you give me a little bit of background about this and the reasoning behind it?
Well, our current charter is about 14 pages. Doesn't doesn't include any term limits for any of our elected officers for Washington County, unlike some other institutions in the area that do actually have term limits. And quite simply, the term limits, it would be two consecutive terms. So right now we have four-year terms here for our commissioners. That would give them 8 years at the helm, and then they'd have to take a break for one election cycle. But it doesn't preclude them from coming back and running again. So it is a balanced way to allow others who would otherwise not be able to run against an incumbent to step into the process of the a citizen politician for a while.
Is this in relation to any of the recent decisions by the Washington County Board, for example, the tax break for Intel and the closure of the public health clinics?
I was actually present for the one with the clinic, and I was there for the joint historic meeting when the city of Hillsborough voted all unanimously, along with the Board of Commissioners in their joint but separate meeting that they conducted. And while we're considering DEQ permitting for Intel, it would have been nice if one of the commissioners who negotiated it would have considered having a little more leverage to say, hey, wouldn't you consider monitoring and actually testing what's coming out of your stacks versus basing it on theoretical numbers? But we didn't do that. And that was the guy who was here 30 years. You would think he would have learned to leverage and use that. And I don't think Intel's leaving town anytime soon after investing $3 billion in their plant at Rahler Acres.
Chairman Andy Dyke has asserted that putting term limits on county commissioners would effectively put county government in the hands of bureaucrats who are, in some sense, unaccountable, while removing the sort of, I think his words were, institutional memory of somebody who has been there at the helm for a long time. How would you respond to that?
You want one word, it'd be hogwash. I think that's one word. It's a false flag, because what you have are, you actually have within the current charter a two-year stagger between the terms of the two groups of commissioners. Districts 1 and 3 term out, and then they go up for election. Districts 2, 4, and the chair that are 2 years later. So at worst, you'd have two remaining commissioners. At best, you'd have three. That's assuming they would term out with their terms. All our current commissioners, basically, at the end of their current terms, will have termed out if, in fact, this ballot initiative gets approved by the voters. I want to add one other thing. Relative to institutional memory, it is a false flag, because you have over 1,800 employees that work for the county. And even if you took half of those and you consider that they're probably there for 10 years or more, you have hundreds of years of experience of county administration staff. And that's who the commissioners turn to when they're in their meetings. They typically look at the bottom of the page of what staff recommends to make the vote. And that's exactly what they did regarding the closure of the clinics. They didn't deviate one iota from what the health director, Marnie Kyle, had recommended in her PowerPoint presentation. That's why I'm wanting new faces and the opportunity for other citizens to step forward to serve as citizen representatives instead of having career politicians who stay longer than they should.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Tom Black, one of the co-petitioners for an initiative that seeks to impose term limits on elected officials in Washington County.
More about the initiative can be found by following their Twitter account at Term Limits numeral 4, WACO.
Last night, the Portland branch of Socialist Alternatives hosted what was billed as a rent control town hall meeting at the First Congregational Church here in downtown Portland. Activists, public servants, civil rights organizers, and concerned citizens all came to discuss the serious issue of rising rent costs and gentrification that is reshaping our fair city. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke earlier today with previous mayoral candidate Nick Caleb about the evening's discussion.
My name is Nicholas Caleb.
First, we could just talk about the state of rent and realty development in Portland. What's your perspective and attitude on those issues right now?
Yeah, I think Portland is in a housing crisis right now, and That's if you look at numbers of the rate at which rent is increasing, and that's just if you talk to people about how they feel about it. In both senses, you know, numbers show bad trends that are making life hard, and people are just like emotionally responding to that. And so I think there's a lot of issues at play, but renters, I think, are feeling it the hardest, and the houseless population, of course.
What demographics are primarily negatively affected by increasing rental prices?
Poor people, mostly. People who are in fixed income, people, single mothers, people that don't have a lot of other alternatives, people that don't have a lot of mobility, especially if they lose their homes, the houseless who could be looking into getting into homes have a harder time getting that. So those are mostly the population.
Well, I know that one kind of solution to some of these issues that are coming up is this idea of rent control. And maybe you could just kind of describe what rent control it is and how it works in other cities that do have that policy.
Sure. Rent control can either be used as a generic term or it can be used to describe specific policy prescriptions. And so if it's used generically, it just means any regulation by the state that seeks to keep rents at an appropriate level. And what's appropriate is something that differs from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Some places tag it to inflation, for example. Rent is reasonably increased as long as it's rising along with inflation. And some places like San Francisco famously have rent control, and it has always been a really hotly debated topic in San Francisco. So you have some people that really, really like it, and then some people that think it actually causes housing distortions that hurt poor people. And so there's a lot of the jury is out, at least for me personally. I don't know exactly where I fall in it, but I think it's one of those tools that would be really nice to have in a city's arsenal to be able to think about implementing it, especially as an emergency situation while we're in crisis.
So if rent control was to be kind of utilized at some point by Portland, would it be broken up by jurisdictions or like neighborhood locations, or would it just be kind of like a cross-the-board application?
It depends. I mean, there's a roadblock in the way that it's preempted by state law right now. One of the reasons why it's not usually seen in Oregon as even a policy option is because in 1985, the legislature banned the use of rent control from cities. So there's that obstacle that's in the way already. But if it were to be utilized as a policy, I mean, it would be up to policymakers to decide how they would want to apply that. You could do it jurisdictionally, or you could do it across the board. The organizers at the Rent Control Forum from Socialist Alternative last night advocated for an across-the-board use of rent control. They thought that was the only way to use it that would actually be equitable and achieve the goals that they were seeking.
What steps would be need? What would need to be taken to overturn that ban at the state level? I mean, would obviously some serious momentum in the legislature. Is there anything being done?
I was just wondering
if there's anything being done to kind of promote the overturning of that ban?
Not that I know of. And that's why last night was so unique, because it was the sort of first public forum that even put this on the list of things that even be talked about. And rent control is kind of one of those, it's just been banished from our list of things that we can think about policy-wise for so long that nobody talks about it. And the Socialist Alternative organizers were really conscious when they started talking about it that they were trying to put this back in the mix and to even get it started as discussion. And what they said is they thought it could potentially be similar to the way that minimum wage raise was talked about when people first started talking about $15 an hour. It was seen as this ridiculous wage, such a humongous increase, and oh my gosh, it's going to destroy everything. And then after the ball started getting rolling on that and people started to study it, it doesn't look so bad anymore. And so now pretty much everybody, at least in Portland, has ceded to the need for a major rent increase. And it's just sort of people are deciding at the state level, and they're deciding at the city how that's going to be implemented and why, when, and what's the phase in, and all the rest of it can be done. But the story has been ceded. The narrative has been ceded. People agree to it. So I think the organizers are hoping to start this discussion so that they can potentially have the same thing happen. People will consider this as something that could be used by cities. And if cities want this, then they can start to lobby. If people want this, then they can start to lobby their state legislators, and maybe there'll be some push at the state legislature.
That was Nick Caleb, previous mayoral candidate, and this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
Protesters shut down an airbase in Nevada today to call for an end to U.S. drone warfare. The protesters pointed out that drones kill many more civilians than combatants. No protesters were arrested today, but the groups plan to continue to protest tomorrow outside the Creech Air Force Base, northwest of Las Vegas. Several advocacy groups, including Veterans for Peace, Code Pink, Women for Peace, and Nevada Desert Experience, are part of the protest. Colonel Ann Wright, a retired Army veteran and State Department official, was one of the participants in today's protests. She spoke with KBOO's Chris Andre from the scene.
So right now I'm standing at right across the road from Creech Assassin Drone Base, which is 60 miles outside of Las Vegas, Nevada. It's a brilliant, clear, blue sky day. It reminds me so much of being in Afghanistan. I reopened the U.S. Embassy there in December of 2001 when I was in the State Department. I resigned a year and a half later over the Iraq War, but I was in Afghanistan. And this place where we are right now, where the operations of assassin drones in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia, in Iraq, in Syria now, where these assassin drones are being operated from, where we're standing here, we can see the modules that these drone pilots are sitting in. And in fact, this is one of the few places, in fact, I think the only place in the United States where you can actually see Reaper and Predator drones. They're flying around right now. They're flying in a traffic pattern, which is the practice sessions for these drone pilots before they actually start operating the drones 10,000 miles away in Afghanistan and Pakistan and other places. So it is really, when you're here and you see what is going on right here and watching these drones, seeing them with your own eyes and thinking about, well, in Afghanistan, these drones could be flying and at any moment a Hellfire missile released and all of our people that are right here, all 140 people right now could be incinerated, obliterated by one of these Hellfire missiles, just like people in wedding parties and people in various other places gathered are incinerated by our U.S. drones.
That was retired Army Colonel Ann Wright speaking today on KBOO's Air Cascadia from the scene of a protest outside an Air Force base in Nevada where drone operations sit and direct weaponized drones dropping bombs on the other side of the world.
Advocates at the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, applaud this morning's announcement by the Ringling Brothers Circus that they'll be phasing out the use of elephants as entertainment by the year 2018. But PETA insists that more can be done sooner. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Brittany Pete, PETA's Deputy Director of Captive Animal Law Enforcement, about their long-standing campaign to improve conditions for circus elephants as well as other performers from the animal kingdom.
Yes, PETA has protested Ringling Brothers' cruelty to elephants for 35 years. PETA has also caught Ringling's abuse on video and released photos of its violent baby elephant training to the world. And if Ringling is really telling the truth about ending this horror, then today is a day for celebration. But there's no reason for these animals to have to suffer one day longer, and Ringling should end these cruel elephant acts today.
Can you go over the role your organization played in the precedent-setting $270,000 fine levied by the federal government in 2011?
PETA has had a very long-standing campaign against Ringling Brothers, and a big facet of that campaign has been the legal effort of PETA's attorneys. And PETA has submitted 124 legal complaints against Ringling Brothers since 1993 alone. And the vast majority of those complaints were submitted to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And each one of those complaints triggers an investigation by the USDA, and it was those investigations that ultimately led to this historic fine.
Do you know how these majestic creatures are obtained or procured?
the vast majority of the elephants that Ringling Brothers uses in its circuses are bred at Ringling's Center for Elephant Conservation in Florida. The Center for Elephant Conservation is a breeding facility where elephants are constantly churned out and the baby elephants are stolen from their mothers shortly after birth, and then they're beaten into submission with bull hooks, which are metal weapons that resemble fireplace pokers that have two sharp tips at the end. And the handlers use those bull hooks along with ropes to force the baby elephants into performing these painful and unnatural circus tricks. And then for the rest of their lives, these animals are forced to perform these tricks under threat of punishment.
What can you share about the company who owns this circus?
Ringling Brothers is owned by Feld Entertainment, which is a billion-dollar company, and it owns the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus, in addition to other entertainment acts, including the Monster Truck Jam, Disney on Ice, Frozen on Ice. And given that this company has made so much money on the backs of these elephants, they can afford to spend some money on these elephants now and make contributions so that every one of these elephants can be sent to a reputable sanctuary where they can have hundreds of miles to roam and the expert veterinary care that they all deserve.
Does your organization feel good about the conditions at this conservation center?
The Center for Elephant Conservation is a breeding facility. It is not a sanctuary. It is not an appropriate permanent home for nearly 50 elephants. It has only 200 acres, which is not even close to what that many elephants need in order to live any semblance of a normal life. The Center for Elephant Conservation is a profit-making facility. Elephants who live at the Center for Elephant Conservation are exploited for breeding. They're exploited for their semen. And the elephants should go to reputable sanctuaries.
I did get a second to go over the press release in response to this announcement, and it suggests that your organization is unwilling to wait over this 3-year phase-out period. Are you at liberty to share PETA's plans to see it transpire sooner?
PETA has put pressure on Ringling Brothers for the past 35 years, and PETA will continue to demonstrate, investigate, and gather documentation of animal abuse just as we have for the past 35 years. This announcement isn't going to change anything until every single animal in the circus is living in a reputable sanctuary.
So for folks who are hearing the conversation that we're having and they want to get involved, what's the one most important thing they can do, and where can they get more information about your organization's efforts?
The most important thing that someone can do if they care about the abuse of animals in the circus is to not go. Don't go to the circus and find out all of the information that you can about the circus and share it with your family, share it on Facebook, share it on Twitter, share it on Instagram. And folks can find all of the information that they need for this at ringlingbeatsanimals.com.
I've been talking with Brittany Pete, Deputy Director at the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals Foundation. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Again, that was Brittany Pete with the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And for more information on this issue, you can visit ringlingbeatsanimals.com.
24-year-old James Dixon has been indicted on manslaughter and federal assault charges for the beating death of 21-year-old trans woman Islan Nettles. The fatal beating took place in Harlem in 2013. The New York District Attorney announced that its 18-month investigation concluded that Dixon's blow to Nettles' face caused her to fall to the ground. Dixon then hit Nettles several more times, resulting in a fatal brain injury that left her on life support. She was eventually declared brain dead and taken off life support. The District Attorney also notes that Nettles was walking with two other trans women on the evening they were attacked. At least seven men jumped the women because they were enraged to learn the women were transgender. The long investigation into Islan Nettles' murder has drawn protests from both local and national trans rights supporters. In January of 2014, Nettle's mother was joined by more than 100 other people outside the New York Police Department to protest the delay and handling of the case.
We're having a breaking news item, another crude oil train derailment. This one, reported by the Chicago Sun-Times, is happening near Chicago this afternoon. The derailment is located near the city of Galena, Illinois, where the Galena River meets the Illinois River. Several cars have caught fire, and firefighters say they're allowing the fire to go ahead and burn itself out. Firefighters from the nearby town, as well as hazardous material responders, are on the scene of the derailment, which had to be reached by a bicycle trail. We will have a full report on this derailment, as well as yesterday's hazardous materials fire at the Port of Vancouver, Canada, on tomorrow's evening news at 5 p.m. Be sure to tune in. You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ethan Martin, Robin Ryan, and Eric Tegedoff. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanko Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or you can look for us on Twitter at KABU News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Pat Epstein. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Anne and Lynn host Positively Revolting Talk Radio, a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, it's APA Compass, a forum for dialogue, exploration, and dissemination of issues pertinent to APA community.